Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest Restless History bonus podcast. Welcome, Wangs, I should say. we're delighted as ever. We are the General Gordon figures, aren't we, Tom?
I suppose we are. But I like the way that the Wangs has, it's kind of organically grown, hasn't it? Because when we started this, we were thinking, what should we call club members? So we've got Athelstans for the elite kind of house carl level. But I like the way that Wangs has, it just feels right, doesn't it?
Yeah, it has the right level of dignity, doesn't it?
But, well, yes, kings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're the Chinese kind of.
And for anyone listening who hasn't heard the first General Gordon episode, all is explained in that. So, Dominic, this week on the Discord.
Yeah, it's all happening.
It's all been happening. It's also been happening on Twitter, where the huge poll was on which historical figure most resembles David Cameron.
So this is a very belated sequel to our Princess and the Tower podcast, because we skipped a week last week because we did our live stream. So we're coming late, aren't we, to the reaction to the Princess and the Tower. And I said in the Princess and the Tower podcast that I thought David Cameron looked like Edward IV.
And we should explain David Cameron, former British Prime Minister, for those
who... Do you think people don't know who David Cameron is?
He's completely forgotten. I mean, you know, if you're American, you're not going to know anything who British Prime Ministers are you?
Maybe not.
But he's... Well, what can I say? I mean, he looks like Edward IV. Well, he looks like a kind of Bourbon, doesn't he? He looks like... He has the look of a kind of sleek 18th century aristocrat who would end up being guillotined.
Not as much as George Osborne, though.
George Osborne.
He's
George
more Osborne.
George Osborne looks like an officer at the Battle of Culloden. Don't you think? A platoon of redcoats going up into the Highlands.
I think he's a man who is cast as an officer in American films about the American War of Independence, isn't he?
He'd have a beauty spot, he'd have a lisp, and he'd burn down the villages of heroic freedom-fighting Americans at the drop of a hat.
He would, exactly.
A tricorn hat.
And that's basically his image in Britain.
Yes, it is.
Because he put VAT, which is the British kind of sales tax, on pasties, didn't he? That was very controversial. Remember that? The pasty tax?
Yes, I mean, that is equivalent to the Battle of Culloden. So Dominic, you said that Edward IV looked very like David Cameron. And other people suggested other people from history that David Cameron looked like. So there was Catherine the Great.
Yeah.
There was George II.
He's descended from. He's descended from George II, I believe.
Is he? Cameron?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Is he descended from Diderot? Who is the other... The great philosopher, no, I thought philosopher.
Diderot was quite a niche choice. There was a slight look of Cameron in the eyes, but I think Cameron never had an encyclopedic enlightened project, didn't he? So I don't think they're comparable figures.
I mean, the limitation of this discussion for a podcast point of view is that nobody can actually see.
No. That's
what
true,
these people
you can
look
go on
like.
Twitter.
But go and have a look at it. Anyway,
the funny thing was, Tom, did you read the responses on Twitter? So a lot of people on Twitter are often incredibly literal-minded. So when you had this poll, who most resembled David Cameron, people were sending really angry replies saying, Cameron took us out of Europe. Catherine the Great never did that.
Well, that's part
anyway,
of the course,
Edward IV won, didn't he?
The funny thing
is that very weekend, Cameron came out in public for the first time in a little while.
Wearing a kind of strange jacket and looking very fat.
Oh, he came out to the Cocklebarrow races, which take place very close to where I live. I know people who spotted him, who were there. They said he was drinking champagne and eating Scotch eggs.
Well, he did look as though he was eating Scotch eggs, but not as though he was drinking champagne.
He looked like he was...
flogging dodgy CDs from the back of a car.
He did. So the culture secretary, Nadine Dorries, who's not known as a great wit, she published a tweet. Did you see this, Tom? Saying,
no.
Advice saying to people, now that Britain has reopened, you know, post-COVID, please go out and enjoy the cultural events that you love. You know, enjoy them safely. But whatever you do, don't buy tickets from touts. And she illustrated that with a picture of Cameron and his coat. Now, my wife told me that coat is actually very fashionable. But he did look like an utter spiff.
Or like Michael Foote's donkey jacket.
Which wasn't a donkey jacket.
At the War Memorial.
Yeah, which was Queen Mother
complimented. It was very stylish.
Him. Yeah. Yeah, so to our foreign listeners, that will mean absolutely nothing. But the Labour Party leader, Michael Foote, in the early 1980s, wore an ill-advised coat to the Cenotaph, to the Remembrance Day service, and was never, ever forgiven by the press or indeed many voters.
Well, I think what this shows is that it's a theme of British political discourse that people wear very, very expensive jackets that look a bit cheap. Yeah. And it adds to the gaiety of the nation.
Yeah, because that coat of Cameron's probably costs like 800 quid or something.
Yeah, of course. Well, I think it's from Marks & Spencer, actually. But expensive.
Cameron would not wear a Marks & Spencer.
No, I think it was an expensive coat from Marks & Spencer. Anyway, this is all absolute gibberish. we should move on. So what else were people talking about? A lot of discussion about popes, interestingly.
Yeah, you love them. Should they represent power? Well, people are constantly... I have the impression that people on the that some of the chat on the Discord is very ecclesiastical.
Well, a lot of vicars, aren't there?
Yeah, and I think they're always saying, why can't we have the top 10 or worst 10 popes?
Well, I think that is an obvious one. The papacy is it's a great subject. It's a huge subject. We haven't really tackled it. You know I love a pope.
Yeah, I'm not a great pope, papal. I'm not a big fan of the Bishop of Rome.
Generally. Well, I'll tell you what I'm very keen to do is, I'm very keen to do one on Gregory the VII.
Which one's he?
He's the Pope who humbled Henry IV at Canossa.
Oh, you love Snows. That. You love that Canossa stuff. I think I've heard you talking about that multiple times, and not even on this podcast, like in general life.
I know. Well, I think it's very, very, very significant. And Gregory
that was your
very,
first
very,
step, I think, away from battles to Christian stuff. Do you not think? You got really excited about that when you wrote Millennium, was it?
Yeah. Well, it kind of opened my eyes to how important it was.
Yeah.
So Gregory the VII was kind of my gateway drug, I guess you'd say.
Yeah.
So I do think we should do one on here. Would you let me do one, please?
Possibly. I mean, Tom, I'm not going to, I don't want to give away our inner workings to the Wangs, but you've come up with some absolutely shocking ideas in the last few weeks. And the Pope's is probably the best of them. So I don't want to embarrass you. So I'm not going to give away some of your ideas because anyway.
There's nothing wrong with pigeons.
Right. So Discord, I've seen this extraordinary graph that basically when we did the live stream, Discord crashed or something.
Yeah, that's great.
Discord outages.
I thought it was outrages.
No. No.
I'm disappointed. I thought it was Discord outages.
People were so outraged.
Well, so what is an outage?
When it collapses, when it crashes. So, granddad. So, the live stream starts at 8 p.m. And if you look on the graph of Discord outages, it kind of worldwide, this is, it kind of shoots up at 8 p.m. and then subsides when their podcast came to an end. I mean, it's possible we're the only podcast in the world that uses Discord, so that would explain it. But it's
there's a comment from a question from Barry Grogan. Is that a graph representing the fear in Dominic's eyes when Tom started to talk about paedophilia, racism, and Mohammed?
See, Tom, I was hoping you weren't going to read that out. You've done it again.
But it was fine, wasn't it?
It's fine so far. I mean, it's fine up till the point where you're cancelled.
But I didn't say anything that was cancellable. I was very, very balanced.
Measured, very measured.
And measured, yeah.
Yeah. So there's also been a big chat on the Discord about Wangs. The Duke of Ormond says a wing of Wangs. Joe Evans Green, a chaos of Wangs, a panic of Wangs, says Richard H., or a wing of Wangs, a wing of Wangs again. Amy Mantravardi, a plague of Wangs. I'm not sure any of those are quite right. I think I don't know, there must be some General Gordon themed.
A poor school of Wangs.
Or an ever victorious army.
Yes, an ever victorious army of Wangs.
Yeah.
Yes, I like that.
So let's move on to some feedback, Tom, specific feedback on episodes and stop sort of blathering. Princes in the Tower. I mean, we had tons of feedback on all of them. So we've just picked out some comments and Sam, our sort of puppet master, has picked out some comments. So the Princes in the Tower, Mary Kirk Alves has a very good question. Even though Sam's written her as Mark Kirk Alves, but we'll assume
it's gender fluid.
She says, I need to ask what I hope is not an utterly dim question. Outside of the Wars of the Roses being a spectacularly better name, why is it not called a civil war? Why is the English Civil War of the 17th century the one and only English Civil War? And then there was a big discussion on Discord about what you need to earn the name Civil War. And of course, we did a Civil Wars podcast. I mean, I would say, and I know not all the listeners, the Wangs, agreed with this, that the difference between the Civil War and previous Civil Wars is that it took place in an age of literacy with sort of mass mobilization. And it was much bloodier, and it involved, you know, places must have been untouched, but no county was untouched. Whereas the Wars of the Roses, I mean, you know, the numbers are quite small. And for a lot of people, it's life is just peasants and stuff. Life is just plodding on as usual.
Do you not think that it's also because it's the last civil war? So it's the one that lives in the memory.
Of course.
So yeah, there were lots of civil wars. I mean, the Wars of the Roses was a civil war. It's called the Civil War. For Shakespeare in Henry VI trilogy and Richard III, it's the emblem of war. The whole cycle is about the horrors of it. And there's the kind of the classic scene where the father who has killed his son and the son who has killed his father, and they kind of meet up on the battlefield and Henry VI listens to it and moans on, talking about how awful civil war is. And of course, Shakespeare is writing that with the consciousness that France, for instance, has exploded into civil war because of the St. Bartholomew Day massacre, that there are religiously inspired civil wars going on the continent, and therefore the risk of civil war is very real. And absolutely, the Wars of the Roses in his plays are being held up as a kind of warning from history. And then before that, there was John's reign is a kind of civil war, even though it has foreign invasion. And then there's the anarchy.
Stephen and Matilda.
So,
but the English Civil War is in a class apart from all those, though, isn't it, Tom? I mean,
well, it's an ideological one as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got a massive ideological religious. It takes place in the age of print with kind of tracts, newspapers. It has a king being killed. It has a republic being set up. It's just in a different league, I would say.
Well, I think also, I think Mary Kirkalvis is American, isn't she?
Yeah.
So in America, the Civil War is obviously the American Civil War. It's interesting that we generally.
No one would call that the Civil War here, would they?
No, but we tend to say the English Civil War. We don't tend to, I mean.
We definitely call it the Civil War.
I don't know. I think there's a tendency to call it the English Civil War or the War of the Three Kingdoms or
no normal
whatever.
Person calls it the War
no,
of the
I agree.
Three Kingdoms.
I agree. But I think people do call it the English Civil War, perhaps.
Maybe. I would say people here, you'd say, let's go to a Civil War battlefield.
Absolutely. All right, Naseby. Yes, of course.
Cromwell was a commander in the Civil War. You would say the Civil War.
Yes, you would. Yeah, you're right.
Hold on. Okay. The American Civil War, that is a brilliant topic. I'm just reading a book right now about William Faulkner and the American Civil War. And it's just absolutely fascinating. We should definitely come to the American Civil War in some future, I think multiple episodes. Anyway,
I'm not going to pretend it's my mastermind subject.
I did it as my university special subject, Tom.
Well, perfect. You can just do the whole thing.
All right, thanks. There. Yeah, of course. I mean, I did it 30 years ago. What could possibly go wrong? So the birth of the railways, that seemed to go down well. People enjoyed it. I'm told by Sam that overexcited Northerners enjoyed it. People talking whether the railways were the north of England's greatest invention. Well, were they the north of England's greatest invention? I thought we dug into that in the podcast, didn't we?
Well, you were Shropshire, weren't you? Yeah. And it turned out to be Bath, which I thought was wonderful.
Well, I think that didn't Dan Jackson say that the Greeks had railways?
Yes, he did. Yeah, and the Germans. But it did turn out actually to be kind of the Wiltshire Bath, the Bradford-on-Avon Bath kind of corridor. Which I hadn't realised, but
I'd like you to miss an opportunity.
I know, yet another invention in the South. And Three Bottle Man.
Yeah, what did Three Bottle Man say?
He took me to task for crediting Northumbria. By this stage, it was County Durham, which really gets credit for anything. Just let us shine, if only ever so briefly. So apologies to Three Bottle Man.
It's a very good county, I think.
It's the burial place of St. Cuthbert.
I knew you were going to mention St. Cuthbert.
And Bede. So yeah. Very good. Yeah, it's...
Mining. I was thinking mining, County Durham.
I always think of saints and ecclesiastical historians.
I'm just grittier.
There it is.
So General Gordon. Now, General Gordon was a funny subject because we chose it thinking it would just be sort of quite obscure and a one-off.
And we thought it would be about kind of 40 minutes, didn't we?
It turned into this great epic because Gordon himself... I love Gordon now. I'm a Gordon stan.
Well, I think both of us just got very into the subject, didn't we?
Yeah.
I mean, we started... I read a lot more about him than I'd anticipated reading about when you suggested the episode. And maybe it'll be the same with you with pigeons.
Maybe, Tom. Yeah, maybe that's... Maybe we'll see. So Tom McCall says he was struck. He wrote this while he was 20 minutes into the first episode. He said he was struck by the parallel between Gordon and his eventual avenger, Kitchener. So this is... Kitchener is obviously the face of in Britain of Great War, World War One, recruiting posters. And Kitchener first made his name in Britain, leading the second great sort of Sudanese expedition, when he avenged Gordon's death, defeated the Mahdist successor, the Khalifa, to spoil the Mahdist tomb and so on. And Tom McCall says, they're both a bit odd, heroic, awkward with women, rumours about impropriety and sexuality, explorers, and then eventually killed in action. He says Kitchener was, he was torpedoed, wasn't he, in the First World War. Maybe it's just something about the kind of men that reach senior positions in the British Victorian military. I think there's actually a degree of truth in that. So there is that sort of archetype of the sort of very repressed...
Spartan.
Yeah. Late Victorian imperial officer in Britain.
I mean, literally Spartan.
Yeah, hanging around with young men, kind of clean-limbed young men.
Cold showers.
Yeah.
Kept away from women.
Yes. Yeah. I don't have an overarching explanation why this should be, except maybe that the late Victorian Britain or the Victorian military fostered this kind of very, very male culture.
I think it was very deliberate. It was... because the officers tended to come from minor public schools,
yeah,
which were consciously modelled on ancient Sparta. I mean, I'm not using the word it unadvisedly. And the whole, you know, the schools were structured like barracks, so that when you then graduated and joined the army and you went into a barracks, it basically felt pretty much the same.
And they are segregated from women, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, and because so they're single-sex schools.
I think that perhaps you just go through your life like that.
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely the case with Gordon, isn't it? Because in the Gordon biography, his biographer John Pollock talks a lot about how awkward with women he was, difficult, founded. Not his sister, interestingly. His sister was his great confidant, but he, you know, sort of shifty, and that's a sort of that's a very British public school kind of stereotype, isn't it? The sort of very reserved man's man.
Who... But against that, the thing that people loved about Gordon was actually that he was hopeless with discipline in lots of ways. I mean, he never actually, after the Crimea, he never kind of really, I mean, his battle honours were all under foreign flags.
Yeah.
And he was always, I mean, the whole thing about Khartoum is that he's disobeying orders.
Yes.
And I suppose actually... an obvious parallel, although in so many ways they're different, would be Custer, who kind of similarly was, I mean, I know he was married, he was lots of all kinds of ways, he was very different from Gordon, but he did have that same kind of charisma and he was admired by people precisely because he did break orders. And, you know, as with Gordon, he ended up very dead.
Yeah, well, they're both cut from that cloth of late Victorian, I mean, as it were, imperial heroes. Who are cut down by, you know, that painting of Gordon on the steps. I mean, that is the ultimate image of empire. You know, he's facing down the mob. And it's even more pronounced, actually, in the Charlton Heston film, where the camera lovingly kind of shows the sort of the faces of the Sudanese looking up at him, and it kind of dwells on their kind of wild expressions, and then Gordon, Charlton Heston's Gordon, looking kind of implacable and unruffled and all this kind of thing, this sort of image of kind of Western heroism. And so I think actually the cowboy and Indian parallel, or the Custer parallel, actually is not a terribly bad one, Tom.
Yeah, except Custer famously laughed at his last moments. It was all a tremendous laugh.
Right, like Vikings. Didn't Vikings always, they always made, you know, laughed in the face of death, didn't they?
That's very much the impression I get from TV shows.
I'm reading a book at the moment by Tom Shippey. You know Tom Shippey?
Yeah, of
you
course.
Know him.
Great
talk. Called Laughing Till I Die. It's about the Viking saga. It's very interesting. Right, Simon Girdleston, he is quite rightly slagging off the ghastly Lytton Strachey, not only a friend of Virginia Woolf, but a man whose own peccadilloes were so unpleasant as to not be repeatable, as his letters to Roger Senhouse later revealed. What are these peccadilloes?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We have to go and research in the Bodleian Library.
Well, I don't want to Google them in case they're, you know, in case the Metropolitan Police come and remove my computer the next morning.
Well, maybe Simon can...
put them on the Discord.
Well, he's saying it's so unpleasant it's not to be repeatable. Maybe he could hint at them.
Now, Mary Kirk Alves says she can't think
she's
of a
modern-day...
modern-day equivalent to Gordon. You might find a crowd shouting for Greta Thunberg or Dan Crenshaw. I don't know who Dan Crenshaw is. Who's Dan Crenshaw, Tom?
Don't know.
Or Elon Musk. But would anyone seriously consider sending any one of them to Kabul? Well, maybe Rory Stewart is the
British analogy. Who, again, will mean nothing to Mary, but he's a dashing former Tory MP who was, he was tutor to Prince Henry, what was he called? William.
Yeah. And then he was at Oxford with me,
Tom. Was he?
I knew him. Yeah. I didn't really know him. He was in the same college. He was about a year above me.
And then he walked, didn't he?
Yeah.
To Afghanistan or something.
18 months he walked across Asia.
So learning.
And he wrote a brilliant book about walking through Afghanistan in the aftermath of September the 11th. So he walked on his own, and he's nearly killed lots of times.
And then in the Iraq War, he became
governor of a province. Hat. Yeah, he became governor of a province. Yeah, an incredible life. So he would perhaps be but also a very eccentric kind of character. So he would be the analogy to Gordon, the British analogy anyway. So reputations. We did a rambling live stream, didn't we, about reputations?
I don't think it was rambling. I think it was very focused.
Did you?
Yeah.
You did a Neanderthal voice, didn't you, at the end?
Yeah.
Tim Vasby Burney. He says, a point made towards the end has got me thinking. We create heroes or fixate on certain individuals to fill a gap. That could be one individual, for example, Martin Luther King, to symbolize the whole movement. It could be identifying someone like Alfred the Great as symbolic of the origins of England, which is absolutely true. For as long as society needs someone to play that role, that person is secure. But when we no longer have that need for the symbol, the person's reputation then comes down. So he says how much Churchill trashing is basically symbolic of shame about being British. If the shame diminished, the trashing would stop. You know, I think that's absolutely right, isn't it? I mean,
yes, I do.
What we often say about Churchill, I think, is that to my mind, when people are attacking Churchill, they're not really attacking Winston Churchill, the genuine flesh and blood figure, so much as they are cherry picking quotations, let's say, from Churchill's life and career, because they want to basically express their misery at being British.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think almost all the sort of major figures of history stand for something. I mean, the reason they're major figures is because they stand for something beyond themselves, don't they? Julius Caesar, when people talk about Julius Caesar, they're really just talking about Rome as much as they're talking about Caesar.
Yeah, well, I'm gearing up to writing about Trajan, who, you know, his famous column.
Yeah.
And, you know, the statue of Trajan that stood there is no longer there because it's a statue of St. Peter.
Okay.
So, things.
Trajan, the best Roman emperor, Tom?
That's what they said.
And do you think he's the best?
No, I think he's not a good emperor.
What?
That's my hot take.
Why?
You have to wait to see when you get the book.
I mean, surely he ruled over the Roman Empire at its greatest extent, didn't he?
He went too far. He reversed the sensible policy of Augustus and Domitian.
Did he conquer the Dacians? Is that what he did?
He did. And it was a mistake. And his invasion of Parthia was a mistake.
Okay.
But the Romans liked it because, you know.
Yeah, but they didn't.
That's what they should be up to. But it was foolish.
Did it cost them that much in the long run?
Well, you have to wait and see.
Okay. Well, so tantalizing. Yeah, I just can't wait.
I know.
Desiree H. The whole discussion made me think about what the people from the 20th and 21st centuries, i.e. our lifetimes, that'll have a lasting reputation centuries down the line, who will fade into obscurity, whose reputation will make the cut and whose won't.
It's a great question, and it's obviously too early to tell.
Yeah, we can't say. I mean, I think my answer to Desiree would be this. Most people have forgotten. Most people who we think are terribly famous are forgotten. So I always think, look at Victorian Britain. Who is genuinely remembered from Victorian Britain? I mean, remembered by the public.
Queen Victoria.
Queen Victoria.
Dickens.
Agreed. Dickens, number two. Isambard Kingdom Brunel, the great engineer who built bridges and stuff that people... He's become the sort of face of Victorian engineering in Britain.
George Eliot, perhaps.
George Eliot? No, most people don't know George Eliot.
I'd say Queen Victoria and Dickens are the...
But I mean, the characters that we've talked about, the Victorian characters that we've talked about in this podcast and the 100-odd episodes that we've done. General Gordon, nobody knows who he is. Gladstone and Disraeli, people have heard the words, but they don't know who they are. Any prime minister? I mean, probably the single Victorian best-known prime minister, I would say, would be the Duke of Wellington. But he's not famous
because
he's famous because of boots and beating Boney.
Yeah.
I mean, that's surely true with US presidents as well. People know Abraham Lincoln. But the others, who cares? Martin Van Buren, Grover Cleveland. I mean,
maybe
no one gives
Andrew
a damn
Jackson,
about them.
Perhaps. Ish.
Maybe, but I mean, no, definitely not outside America. No one's heard of him outside America, have they?
So,
I mean, you're talking about a handful of people that are remembered from any moment in history. A writer, an inventor.
So I know we disagree about this. I think the Beatles may be remembered.
Maybe.
I think that we kind of touched on this in the 1922 episode. that one of the things that had changed over the 20th century, and it's definitely the case now, is a suspicion of, you know, great artistic achievement. Basically, Joyce and Eliot, that kind of Proust, that Picasso, Stravinsky, that generation of modernists were the last generation where you could say, yes, they were great, towering figures, and they're famous for being kind of famous writers or painters or whatever.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, you know, are there famous composers now or?
Not classical
famous
composers.
Artists or?
No, and if you think about novelists, for example, take American novelists. Probably the greatest American novelist since the... I mean, who are the greatest American novelists since the Second World War?
Cormac McCarthy.
Cormac McCarthy, Philip
Roth. Marilyn Robinson.
John Updike, maybe. Toni Morrison. Maybe Toni Morrison will be remembered. I don't know.
They're
not names huge, to conjure with for the public, are they? I would say.
And even political figures.
In Britain, in our lifetime, Thatcher. First woman, Falklands.
Yes, but I mean, on the centuries down the line... So 500 years, 600 years, I don't think so.
No. Do you know what? One reason is that they're all too short-lived. I mean, in the States, for example, a president gets 8 years max. And in the grand scheme of things, that's nowhere near enough time, is it? I mean,
no. So maybe
Putin has been leading Russia since the beginning of 2000, January 2000, I think.
But his reputation may not be a good one.
No, it may well not be a good one, but he will definitely be remembered.
Mm-hmm.
Xi Jinping, maybe. Well, I mean,
kind of starting a war is winning a war is always a good way to be remembered. So hopefully, you know, the fact that people aren't remembered is a good sign. Anyway, and then Charles I, execution thereof. Mike Chapman, I haven't finished the episode yet, but I'm getting strong Tsar Nicholas II vibes about Charles I. On a personal level, not a bad person, but stubbornness, belief in a unique right to rule, and a tendency to go back on what you've agreed led to enormous bloodshed and similarly unfortunate endings. It's a good parallel.
I think it's a really good point. I think that made me wonder whether, is that because there are genuine similarities or because almost they're cast in the same role? Because the implosion of the regime, the state of politics, mean they end up playing the same part,
well,
even if they don't have the same...
There's also a very good point from James Hellier. I think one of the big problems that James and Charles had was that they were too nice. If you crossed a Tudor, you ended up dead and with your estate seized by the crown and distributed by favour. If you crossed a Stuart, you joined Parliament. I mean, Elizabeth, likewise, was the opportunity to behave like Henry VIII had kind of basically faded with Henry VIII. So Elizabeth also was kind of treading a fine line. But I think the general point that, you know, we touched on in the episode where you said, you know, Charles I to Ted, you know, he's not Nero.
Yeah.
You know, he's not an absolute monster. But perhaps if he had behaved like a monster.
I think you're absolutely right, Tom.
And Nicholas II isn't actually a monster.
Agreed. Very repressive people often don't come to this as sticky endings as people who are weak and well-meaning. I mean, that's unpalatable to say, but basically if you're an autocratic ruler faced with an uprising or a revolution, I would say generally your best way of getting out alive is to kill your opponents pretty quickly.
And the parallel is also with Louis XVI, that Charles has a tyranny, as it's called, you know, a personal rule where he doesn't call Parliament. And it's when he calls Parliament that all his problems begin. I mean, he has no choice. He's run out of money. But the same thing happens with Louis XVI.
And the Estates General. Exactly.
Estates General, and it all goes wrong.
I think now, Louis XVI was a more conscious moderniser than... Well, although Ted would say Charles is being a moderniser because he's trying to copy...
in an absolutist way.
Yeah, European absolutism. So I think there are between those three figures, Charles I, Louis XVI, and Nicholas II, there are definitely really interesting parallels. And they're all interestingly attacked in every case because of their wife. And their wife becomes...
Fascinating.
Their
yes.
foreign wife
yes.
becomes
yes.
the subject of kind of very, prurient, very aggressive, prurient.
Yeah.
And I think that is a really, really interesting...
Well, actually, is Henrietta Maria? I can't remember.
Well, Henrietta Maria, it's more, it's not so pornographic.
She's
it's not
papist.
So prurient, but it's the suspicion that she's the head of some
whore
papist
of
conspiracy. Marie Antoinette, obviously, because she's the Austrian whore and she gets all this terrible grief. And then with Alexandra, she's a German spy. She's sleeping with Rasputin.
Yeah.
You know, it's extraordinary, actually.
Now, Dominic, I have continued my research into this subject.
Ooh.
Because we're recording this on Monday the 31st, so the last day of January.
Yeah.
And the 30th of January, so Sunday, is famous for two great events in British history. And I celebrated them both yesterday evening. So the first, obviously, is the Get Back concert. Beatles' last appearance. Right. So that was staged at the IMAX, and I went to see that last night.
You've seen it already?
I've seen it twice. That was my third watching.
Oh, my God. That is
it was brilliant. Peter Jackson appeared.
Not in the flesh, presumably.
He was a kind of live link-up from New Zealand. He gave great answers. I mean, he was being asked questions that he must have heard a million times. And he
What's your favourite Beatles album? Considered.
No, it wasn't. It was very, very good. Anyway, but before that, I saw that church I sometimes go to, St. Bartholomew the Great, London's oldest church that we might do when we do our London episode.
Yeah.
Founded by the jester of Henry the First. So fabulous church. And it was evensong, and it was to mark the martyrdom of Charles the First.
Oh, wow.
So there were three hymns. Shall I read you?
You can sing them.
Some of the verses. I can't remember how it went. I'll read it to you. So this is two of the verses from one of the hymns. In the very dead of winter, underneath a bitter sky, silent crowds in frozen horror come to see their sovereign die. Silent stand the surly troopers, silent fall the people's tears, silent steps he to the scaffold, silent lips are moved to prayers. At the block, he says, remember, lays aside his Georgian gown, kneels in prayer, then gives the signal, which bestows the martyr's crown. As she sees his lifeblood flowing, England shudders at her fate, dreading who may next be slaughtered, victim of the rebels' hate.
You sang that.
I wish we'd had that. I could have sung that to Ted. He would have loved it. But there was, and so I was kind of, you know, is this for real? I mean, these are ridiculous. And then the rector, the Reverend Marcus Walker, who's a very smart, sophisticated, funny man. And in his sermon, which he sent to me because I enjoyed it so much, he said, there is, of course, something a tad ridiculous about relitigating the civil and religious wars of the 17th century in the year of grace 2022. And he described the hymns as ridiculous. But he gave a fabulous sermon, giving three reasons why the day is still worth marking. First, because we have to remain alert to the ways in which a nation slips into civic dispute and civil war. The second, the way that Charles I basically wins because he is able to stamp the trial as illegitimate.
Yeah.
And so the argument, Marcus's argument was that...
Had he been listening to our podcast?
Don't know. No, I don't think so. That it's important when you disagree with fellow citizens to keep it legal. And the final reason he says... and why it should be given from a pulpit rather than from a, you know, just a kind of secular lecture pulpit, is that King Charles ended up giving, rather to his surprise and not entirely in the way he wanted, the Church of England a real identity. And the argument is that the result of it was that it was a church which realized it could never rid itself of the other side. So that's the Anglo-Catholics and the Presbyterians that both in the wake of the Civil War, the execution and Cromwell kind of basically got together, and they've stuck together ever since. So I thought that was very interesting.
That's sort of skipping over the fact that they all the intense quarrelling for the next 60 years or so, isn't it?
Well, no, because he says the quarrelling is going on. He condemns the zealotry of William Gladstone, who removed the anniversary from the prayer book in the 1850s.
The Reverend Marcus Walker was condemning Gladstone.
Condemning the zealotry of William Gladstone from the pulpit.
Wow.
And pointing out that he's been elected to the synod, so maybe moving to have that restored. But I thought it was interesting because obviously we've talked about the English Civil War quite a lot, and we've agreed that the themes and the kind of issues at stake continue to reverberate certainly into the present day. But obviously the specific issues of the Civil War don't. But there've been a couple of times where I've kind of felt just the faint glow of the issues. So yesterday evening, I could see, you know, what the royalist take might have been. I could kind of warm my hands by the glow of the argument. Yeah. And the other time I felt that was when I went to see. Have you seen Kevin Brownlow's film Win Stanley?
No, Ted's always telling me about that.
It's very good, and they showed it at the National Film Theatre. And I went to see it, and there were lots of people who you could imagine kind of on picket lines.
Yeah. Well, this is what happens at Level a Day at Burford.
Right. You know,
have you been to that?
No, I haven't. I'd love to go to that. I'd love to. I've never been to the memorial in Whitehall for Charles I, and I've never been to the Leveller Memorial at Burford. But it would be fun to do them both. Maybe next year we should.
I think I shudder at the thought of Leveller.
Oh no! I think it would be great. We could do one half on Charles I and one half on the Levellers.
But
actually going to
they're months
the,
apart. The Leveller Day is in summer. Fine. I think.
Well, it's planning.
Don't think I'd be persona grata. At the
Dominic, come on. I think that's a great idea.
Well, it's just down the road from me, Burford. I mean, I sometimes go there to they've got a very, very posh garden centre. So I go for that reason.
It's what John Lilburn would have wanted.
Exactly. Right. Now, Tom, we are talking in the immediate aftermath of the release of our Babylon podcast.
Yes.
I think we should be honest with our wangs and say that we have actually recorded two Babylon podcasts, but we are saving one for a rainy day, which is the very early
Hammurabi and
yes.
stuff.
So that's in the bank and waiting to be released on an unsuspecting world. But the one thing that a lot of people said on Twitter they were disappointed by was that we mentioned Boney M, but you didn't do it. You didn't sing it and you didn't give it the performance that I think your fans were hoping for.
Well, I mean, obviously Boney M, friends of the show, We didn't sing Rasputin, did we?
No, we didn't.
So this is an unsettling precedent.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to. I'm just saying, throwing it out there.
But I'm for the wangs,
yeah.
And only for the wangs, why don't I take us out by singing...
That'd be delightful.
Rivers of Babylon in the style of a Neanderthal.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, do. Perfect.
So thanks very much for listening. We will see you next week.
Bye-bye.
And here is Rivers of Babylon. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yeah, we wept when we remembered Zion.